Asking the questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the White House is preparing to target Iran with the strongest sanctions in history. He said the U.S. was ready to respond if Iran resumed its nuclear program and challenged Tehran to change its behavior. Our Washington correspondent Harry Horton reports.
Earlier this month, the U.S. pulled out of a nuclear agreement with Iran. Now, Mike Pompeo has outlined what he called 12 very basic requirements for a new deal, but U.S. allies will likely see them as anything but. Pompeo's demands for Iran included ending missile production, disarming militia groups, and withdrawing from Syria. He also said tough economic sanctions would apply to other countries seeking business with Iran, a blow to European allies hoping to keep the current nuclear deal alive.
President Donald Trump says China has agreed to buy massive amounts of additional agricultural products from the United States. China says that, following talks with a top official, the two nations have agreed not to engage in a trade war. FSN's Daniel Wrenches has this report.
Following last week's talks in the U.S. Capitol with Vice Premier Liu He, the U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said they were putting the trade war on hold, echoing comments made by the Chinese special envoy on his return home. President Trump tweeted that the massive amounts of additional farm products would be practically as much as our farmers can produce. But many questions remain, including the status of talks on technology goods and whether this deal is linked to China's support for Trump's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un next month.
Gina Haspel has been sworn in as the new director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. She becomes the first woman to head up the CIA, despite a controversial past that includes running a black site prison where waterboarding took place. The public inquiry into the Grenfell Tower disaster is opening in London. Families of those who died in the fire have the chance to make statements to the inquiry as it opens. Grenfell Tower caught fire on June 14, 2017, leading to 72 deaths. The first official royal wedding photos have been released after Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's marriage. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex were married in Windsor on Saturday. Ollie Barrett has more from London.
Three photos have been released by Kensington Palace, one with just the happy couple, one with the bridesmaids and page boys, and another also with close family, including the Queen and Meghan's mother, Doria Ragland. They were taken by photographer Alexei Lubomirsky, and the palace's statement says Meghan and Harry are delighted with them. And the palace says Meghan and Harry also want to thank everyone who took part in celebrations over the weekend.
From Euros Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks very much, Rebecca Foster. Welcome to Monday's Richie Allen Show. How are you? Hope you've had a good weekend. Hope you've enjoyed the weather. It's been glorious right across the UK. Good to be back with you. I've got a terrific show lined up today.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, I've got a nice and varied program for you this evening. Later on, the geopolitical analyst, the journalist and historian Scott Rickard is back on the program. Delighted to have Scott back. We'll be running the rule over the big stories of the last few days and the last week. No better man than Scott. He joins us in the second hour. Before that, though, we'll be joined live from Sweden by Anneli Kubai. Now, Anneli taught me how to pronounce her surname today. I hope I've got that right. It's Anneli Kubai. Now, she was a high school teacher for 22 years. She still teaches Swedish and French, but not to high school students. A couple of years ago, she lost her job because of her political opinions, because of her conservative viewpoints and her stance on feminism. This isn't a joke, it's true. She's going to be chatting with us about multiculturalism, gender, identity issues, and why she believes there is a tyranny of consensus in Sweden. She's a really interesting lady, and she joins us this hour. You don't want to miss that. If you've got any opinions, and I'm sure you have, tweet them as usual to @RichieAllenShow. That's my Twitter handle, @RichieAllenShow. Tweet your opinions to me. It's Monday, the 21st of May, 2018, and I'm Richie Allen. There you go. How are you? You all right? Listen, thanks for your understanding yesterday. Never been one. I think it's the first time I've ever done it, actually, when I've decided, with no great reason, to take a morning off. What it is the future, Mrs. Allen. Let's just say from now on in, my partner, Caroline, is 40 this week. She will be 40 on Wednesday. And my present to her was basically to arrange for her and her family and friends to have a bash in Nancy in the east of France on Wednesday. And she's going to be away for the best part of a week. So yesterday morning, with the weather being amazing and all of that, plus there was nothing in the Sunday newspapers except that bastard wedding, that blasted bollocks of a wedding. I said, well, sure, what are we going to talk about? There was nothing but the wedding. So I said, right, I'm going to go out in the sun, take a drive, which is what I did. Thanks for understanding and not getting too peeved off about that. Yeah. I have one thought and one thought only on that wedding. An observation I've made. I do not believe that there was as much public interest in it as the media would have you believe. I think a lot of the public interest in it has been manufactured. I really do believe that. I believe a lot of it was staged. I think the vast majority of people, I can speak for Manchester anyway, this great republic of Mancunia here, where people didn't give an arse. They didn't. There was no bunting, no interest, no street parties, no nothing. I believe a lot of the interest in this is overhyped, overblown by the UK's media. Of course, the conduct of Sky News, ITV News and BBC News was disgraceful over the course of the week leading up to it and over the weekend. Disgraceful conduct. It was as far from journalism as you could possibly get. That's all I have to say on it. It's a farce, a charade, mind control across the board. Here you have this obviously very strange young woman, pretty or not, right, with a very weird background, claiming to be a feminist and then marrying into a family where she'll have to refer to her father-in-law as Your Highness and curtsy to him and do what her husband tells her and her husband's grandfather and all the rest of it. It couldn't be any further from feminism. That's all I'm going to say. Not that I have any interest in isms myself. Right, shut up, Richie, and crack on. A few things I want to get through before we introduce our first guest. And speaking of our first guest, I'm going to kick off with this story. I'm not going to talk about Iran or China and the US. We'll leave that for Scott Rickard later on, because Scott's always got some really interesting insights into these things. I'll leave that alone and we'll do a bit of a detour away from the main stories. Australian schools are thinking about abolishing the use of the terms boy and girl. This is not a joke. It's not new either. This has been spoken about for some time, but in the Australian mainstream press over the weekend, this resurfaced. Victorian councils. That's not Victorian as in the UK, Victorian, 17th century, 18th century, whatever. Victorian as in the state of Victoria. Their councils are responding to a study by Australian National University, which concluded that educators should avoid use of the terms boy and girl, and that's according to the Herald Sun, who also said, did the Herald Sun, that some of our favourite children's cartoons and children's television shows could disappear because of their lack of gender sensitivities or whatever the hell. Here is Sunrise News, breakfast television show Sunrise in Australia.
Victorian councils are reportedly considering banning children's books, toys or characters that don't meet strict gender guidelines. The Herald Sun says that some councils are auditing learning materials at libraries, schools and kindergartens and urging a ban on the terms boy and girl. The City of Melbourne Council is among several local authorities responding to new research about gender equality. Under the new guidelines, children's favourites such as Thomas the Tank Engine and Winnie the Pooh could be banned for not meeting gender tests.
Yes, ban Winnie the Pooh. Ban Thomas the Tank Engine. Which, if you remember, last year, or maybe it was 2016 maybe, the United Nations expressed concern about fat shaming in Thomas the Tank Engine because of the fat controller, who's a really important character in Thomas the Tank Engine. He's a character of authority, respected by the engines, by Thomas and Percy and Gordon and James. But he can't be called a fat controller. We've got to change that. This is not funny anymore. When I started covering this a few years ago, I thought it was hysterically funny, and I didn't really see the bigger picture at that time. It's no longer funny. This is deadly serious, and I'll be chatting about this with my guest from Sweden, in about 15 minutes' time. Yeah, ban Thomas the Tank Engine. Basically, this study by Australia University said that prejudice and gender lines can be recognised in children as young as 3 and 4. So Barney, presumably Sesame Street, everything is going to have to be changed. Councils even across Victoria are taking the study basically as fact. They're taking the study as law. Well, they're converting it into law and are reviewing their educational resources to make sure there are no gender stereotypical narratives. Talked about this on Thursday, didn't I? But I'm going to get into it a bit later on. German popular daily newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung fired its elderly cartoonist because he drew a caricature of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Right, fair enough. But there was a Twitter storm. These days, people's whole careers are being decided by judge and jury type Twitter storms. Yeah, what the cartoon portrayed was basically Netanyahu in the likeness of this Israeli singer who won the Eurovision Song Contest, somebody called Netta Barzilay. So the cartoonist, made Netanyahu look like this singer holding a missile in his hand, and the text above him said, "Next year in Jerusalem." It's satirical, it's funny, but no! Because the chief editor of the newspaper, Wolfgang Krach, he issued his apologies, but the 85-year-old cartoonist called Dieter Hanitsch, he said, "No, I'm not apologising." Saw that, and he was fired. Lovely. Some world we're living in now, where people you never met, people who don't live in Germany, can get you fired because they don't like what you think. Here's Gideon Levy. Gideon Levy is from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Shall we hear him? Yes, we'll hear him. Shall we hear him? Yes, we'll hear him.
Whenever it comes to Israel, not only to Netanyahu, to Israel in general, immediately the European media is scared of being accused of anti-Semitism. While any other leader, you can do whatever you want. Whenever you draw a Israeli statesman, whenever you criticize Israel, immediately it comes up, oh, anti-Semitism. And Europe is afraid, really scared, paralyzed of being labeled as anti-Semite. Rightly so, by the way.
Rightly so, by the way. Fuck off, Gideon. Nobody should be paralyzed with fear. And you were doing so well there, Gideon, by the way, speaking to RT. Nobody should be paralysed by fear. Let's not say anything against Israel, lest we be labelled anti-Semitic. Foolish thing for him to say. He goes on.
The way. The only problem is that this has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. And I hope that German colleagues in the German media will raise a voice of protest against this scandal of firing this cartoonist.
Yes, of course, he redeemed himself nearly in the end. Of course, the 85-year-old cartoonist shouldn't have been fired for what is an amusing and satirical cartoon. When will people wake up to the fact? And I'm talking about regular folk, not affected by this. When will they come to the realisation? Something is very, very, very wrong. When you cannot breathe a word of criticism against this pariah, murderous, apartheid state, because if you do, you'll be targeted and you'll probably lose your job, as this 85-year-old cartoonist has found. Might try and get him on the show, see how we get on with that. More on Israel in the second hour of the programme. Here's one that'll drive you mad. This is in The Independent today. Hundreds of homeless people fined and imprisoned for begging and rough sleeping. Now, The Independent reports, and their figures are accurate, they are peer-reviewed figures, that the number of people sleeping rough in England is at a record high. There has been a 73% increase over the last 3 years alone. Hunger Games Society, anyone? And you know what's happening to homeless people? They're being fined, they don't have any money, I don't know what they expect of them, getting criminal convictions, and they are even being sentenced to prison for begging and for rough sleeping. We'll come to that in a second. 51 people have reportedly been convicted of breaching a public space protection order, which is called a PISPO or PSPO. 51 people for begging or loitering and failing to pay fines up to £1,100 since 2014. Hundreds of fixed penalty notices have been issued. We live in a madhouse, you see. This isn't a lunatic asylum we live in, where people can give a fixed penalty notice to somebody who is down on their luck, who is on their arse. Fine them £1,100. 50 local authorities have these PSPOs in place, these PISPOs, despite Home Office guidance at the start of the year telling councils not to target people for sleeping rough and for being homeless. A couple of cases that they mention in The Independent. A man was jailed for 4 months for breaching a criminal behaviour order in Gloucester. For what? For begging. The judge even said, in summing up, I will be sending a man to prison for asking for food when he was hungry. Right. In another case, a man was fined £105 after a child dropped £2 in his sleeping bag. That's insanity beyond where I can't even find words to describe it. A parent teaches a child we should be compassionate and we should help those worse off than ourselves, if we can. Today we can, child. Give that man £2. The child gives the man £2. The man is fined £105. Mad, right? And we're going to see more of this, of course, as this system drives people into the gutter, which it is designed to do. 73% increase in rough sleeping in the last 3 years. Imagine what it'll be like in 2030. 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London, has announced late this afternoon that he is resigning from the Labour Party. The ex-London mayor, of course, as you know, has been suspended for nearly 2 years in a row over allegations of anti-Semitism because Ken made comments about Hitler and Zionism, accurate comments as it happens. Livingstone maintains today that he still will not accept that he was guilty of anti-Semitism or bringing Labour into disrepute, but he said his case had become a distraction for the party and its political ambitions. Jeremy Corbyn, who has basically thrown him under a bus, said it was a sad moment, but nevertheless the right thing to do. Yeah. Yes, the right thing to do, Jeremy. Somebody who's been a friend of yours since you were just out of short trousers has never said anything remotely hateful or remotely racist about Israel, but you're happy to see him go because you've got designs on winning the next election. What a lovely man. Ken said he abhorred anti-Semitism and was truly sorry that his historical arguments had caused offence and upset in the Jewish community. There is so much wrong with that, Ken. Don't apologise to these tyrants, to these lunatics. What you said was a fact, a historical fact. Leave it at that. Leave it at that. And shame on you, Ken, for resigning and making it easier for Corbyn and Shami Chakrabarty. You should have made them fire you. Or, excuse me, it wasn't working for the Labour Party. You should have forced their hand to make them bar you from the party. Dreadful. Dreadful. Last week, speaking of Chakrabarty, Shami Chakrabarty, she called for his expulsion last week, which signalled to, I suppose, Labour Party supporters that the leadership had turned against him. Shami Chakrabarty, the greatest pain in the arse since the advent of the tetanus shot. What a horrible person. What a clown. Ah, Ken Livingstone. And on the Gaza massacre last week, Israeli officials announced on Friday that they will completely refuse all cooperation with any UN probe into the Nakba Day murders of 61 Palestinian protesters. The Israelis have said, we don't care. A UN Security Council resolution failed to agree on the investigation because it was vetoed by the United States. The UN Human Rights Council, by the way, doesn't need or doesn't have to worry about vetoes. The UN Human Rights Council doesn't need permission to investigate. It held a special session and it has agreed to send investigators in, but the Israelis won't cooperate. They might not even admit the investigators into the country. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. 21 minutes past the hour. This is your Richie Allen Show live on Fab Radio 2. Tune in radio, richieallen.co.uk and triggerwarning.tv. Always good to have your company. Thanks for choosing the programme this Monday. Two terrific guests lined up. Coming up in a second, Anneli Khubai joins us live from Sweden. We're going to be talking about gender politics. We're going to be talking about feminism. We're going to be talking about the tyranny of consensus. Terrific lady. Really looking forward to you meeting her. Back in a minute after these.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Right, welcome back to the programme. Great to be with you. 23 minutes past the hour. While I get my guest on the line from Sweden, let's have this from Barry White. Have we got some Barry White? We do.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. As many times as we've loved and have shared love and made love. It doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough. It's just not enough.
My darling, I can't get enough of your love, baby. Girl, I don't know why I can't get enough of your love, baby. Lord, some things I can't get used to. No matter how I try, it's like the more you give, the more I want. That's no lie. Oh, no, baby. Tell me, what can I say? What am I gonna do? How should I feel with everything in you? What kind of love is this that you're giving me? Is it in your kiss or just because you're sweet? Girl, all I know is every time you're here, I feel a change. Something moving, I scream your name. Look what you got to do with, darling. I can't get enough of your love, baby. Girl, I don't know why I can't get enough of your love, baby. Oh, no, baby. Girl, if I could only make you see and make you understand. Girl, your love for me is all I need, and more than I can stand. Oh, well, babe, how can I explain all the things I've been...
Right, music from Barry White on your Richie Allen Show. It's exactly 26 minutes past the hour. Welcome to the program, if you're just joining us. Thanks for all the tweets. Do tweet the program. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Send me a tweet. Tell me what you're thinking about these issues. So, to the story I covered at the very beginning of the program, the story coming out of Australia, and we've seen it here in the UK as well. Children's books being banned and taken out of circulation because they reinforce gender stereotypes. This is dangerous, of course. It's a very serious issue. Where is it all going to end? Now, I was researching this earlier on today and I came across our first guest and I'm delighted I did. She is a remarkable lady. She is a French and Swedish teacher. She was a high school teacher for 22 years and about 3 years ago she was fired over her political opinions. This is true, disgusting, but true. She took on radical feminism and took some students to a feminist talk. They asked questions, they got involved in the debate, but there was a social media storm. She was accused of sexism and racism, and she eventually lost her job. She believes the Swedish education system today is an indoctrination system, and we've heard that before. Here in the UK. She used a terrific way of describing this. I mentioned to her when we spoke a little earlier, she's called it a tyranny of consensus. I think it's really important that we talk about this today. Let's welcome to the programme. She's live in Söderköping. I hope I said that right. Söderköping. It's Annelie Hubai. Annelie, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Thank you. I'm fine. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thanks for doing it. The pronunciations are disgraceful, mine, but I think you might forgive me anyway. Thanks for coming on.
Good.
I tried my best. You're in East Sweden, kind of southeast Sweden. It's obviously beautiful there. Tell me, when I was reading about you today, one of the things that I found really annoying was that your school didn't support you, didn't stand up for you. Were you surprised by that? How hurtful was that?
Yes, I was very, very surprised and disappointed, of course, because everyone told me that you're a very good teacher and you know your subjects so well, you get along with all students and everything. But since the day I started to criticize feminism and I had that hate storm, people sending mails and called my employees and my city, the politicians there, they started not to stand up for me. And I was really, really shocked because I've worked there for so long, since my youngest kid was born even. So, and that was the town where I was born and grew up. So, well, that was a really shock to me.
Why do you think the school didn't support you? Was it because the school was scared about being labeled as subversive, maybe?
Yes, I think that is the most important thing. They were afraid of losing students, having a bad reputation because of a teacher not calling herself a feminist, because everyone should do that. You were supposed to be a feminist, because if you're a feminist, you're a good person, and if you're not supporting this the feminism in Sweden, the Swedish model of feminism, you are an evil person.
Wow.
that was the debate climate then. Now it's changing a little bit, but I was before my time, I think.
Had you, in the previous years, had you noticed that things were changing with regard to teaching? Was teaching changing? Were things becoming different?
Yes, I started to notice that. I've been thinking a lot about that. And I think it was about around 2000. But I think it started earlier than that. But that was when I started to notice that something was happening. We were not just doing education in school. We were doing some kind of social engineering or propaganda and making good citizens of our students instead of teaching them.
Instead of teaching them to think for themselves. Annelie, is there one even small example that you can give me from 2000, the year 2000, or more recently? Is there something that you remember, one example?
Yeah, I remember that we were having studies that we were supposed to investigate structures of powers in literature between men and women, and counting authors. Are students reading as much female authors as male authors? Not instead of looking what kind of books are they reading? Are they reading at all? Yes, and there was some kind of focus on gender all the time that I was not used to. So they were kind of focus on gender in a quite stereotypical way, I think.
Right. So what you were seeing there was, it was a slanted debate. They wanted the children to read more female authors and academics, regardless of whether the writing was any good.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And not. And it was about not only female and male. It was some kind of you should read literature from poor countries, from black authors, and about homosexual persons and everything. That was not something I've ever thought of before. But now it was so. There was a kind of a battle between male and female, between poor and rich, and black and white. I didn't recognize that anymore.
And this came in post 2000. Let me remind our listeners, we're delighted tonight to have Annelie Khubai. She's a teacher, still teaching French and Swedish today, but spent over 22 years at a high school, was wrongly fired because she had encouraged her students to challenge feminist thinking, to challenge it in an academic way. There was a Twitter storm and a social media storm over that. And Annelie is talking about the changes that she noticed in education. Annelie, tell me this. When did gender neutral as an idea, when did you first hear about that?
Oh, that is a good question. I think about around 2010 or something.
Yeah.
Then it became very, very common. And everyone was starting to use that gender neutral pronouns, and that was a kind that was looked as political correct, and if you were not using that, you were oppressing people, and excuse me, I call it rubbish, but
that's okay.
So I think it was about 2010, around there somewhere.
And was it the case that you as the teaching staff were being asked to tell the children that it is important to, you know, think about gender as a fluid thing and that it's important to use somebody's preferred pronouns? Was that very was that a very serious thing?
Yes, it was. And I lately I even met students who told me that everyone in the world should have their own pronoun, even if they were 40 or 50, that didn't matter. Everyone should choose their own pronouns. And I thought that was kind of ridiculous, because if you have he and she, and in Swedish we have also hen,
right,
that is gender neutral. But they started to talk about even more gender pronouns. So,
Wow. And
we have in the Swedish school system, we have it in the curriculum that we should discourage traditional gender roles. So you are supposed as a teacher to do that. But I never thought of that as really trying to transform children, only to make everyone do what they want. That is quite natural, I think, but trying to remake them to something that they aren't.
Tell me this. You said that teachers were almost told to discourage children from adopting traditional gender ideas. How did that work? How were they discouraged? Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, you should not talk about that, for example, boys were preferring some kind of literature and girls were preferring other kinds of books. You were supposed to let them read almost the opposite that they wanted to read, just to not being gender traditional.
Well,
a lot of small details that was kind of bizarre.
Annelie, tell me this. Did anybody in the education system, in the government, did anybody consult the parents of these children? Because these are radical changes. Were the parents involved?
No, I don't think they knew. I don't think they had no idea, because most parents think that their children are going to school and it's exactly the way it was when they were in school, but it's not. And students were making films instead of studying for showing that there are boys are oppressing girls and girls are always oppressed by boys. It's always this kind of that girls are the victims and boys and young men are the oppressors.
And was this national, Annelie? Do you think this was a national program?
Yes, it was a kind of, it were everywhere, in the universities, in the education for teachers, everyone was studying gender studies. It is very important in, for example, education for all teachers in Sweden.
Was there any opposition amongst the teachers, Annelie? Were there teachers saying, this is crazy?
No.
No?
Not. They, I think they thought it was, but they, you know, they keep quiet and do as they are told. And they are supposed to, no one, this is the tyranny of consensus. No one, everybody is afraid to do something that the rest doesn't do. So they follow the stream.
And then because of what happened to you, if there are teachers today, if they have a conservative outlook on life, if their politics are conservative, they're probably a bit scared to say anything, Annelie.
Yes, there are a lot of teachers who they, I'm not so very different from others. I have the opinions that many teachers and people in Sweden have, but many people are afraid to say that. That it's natural. There are boys and there are girls. There are men and there are women. That is controversial today to say that. It's amazing.
It is amazing. And I did mention to you today what you've experienced in Sweden. I think you are further down the road than we are, but we're getting there. The million-dollar question, Annelie, is why? Why do you think this is happening? What's the reason for this agenda?
I have no idea, but I think it could be a dangerous weapon, because if you're fighting something that are biological inherent to people, you are fighting the nature. Gender is a biological construction and a social construction. And I don't know why this is happening, or is it just being stupid, or is someone thinking that it could be making a war on gender? Can that be a gain for someone? I don't know. Who?
There's a huge amount of interest in this, understandably. A lot of tweets are coming in. You can follow you can follow Annelie on Twitter as well, by the way. I'm going to tweet to Annelie, and you'll see her Twitter account there. Annelie Kubai is live on the line from Söderköping, which is in southeast Sweden. She's a very experienced teacher, very well liked too. I saw her do an excellent interview this morning with a Swedish journalist, and I said, I've got to get this lady on our show talking about this, because she's experienced the tyranny of consensus. When conservative thinking, or just slightly right-of-centre thinking, challenging the feminist agenda, the gender-neutral policies and this sort of thing, a Twitter storm, a social media storm, meant that she was forced to leave her job, even though she had a perfect record as a teacher for over 20 years. You said something, Annelie, that's really concerning. You said that the opinion corridor is narrowing. Now, that sounds like George Orwell, doesn't it? It sounds like we're getting to a place where there is an accepted point of view on any issue, and everybody must have that point of view. Everybody must agree, or you're in trouble. That's very these are very dangerous times, I think.
Yes, and it's in media, but it is also, for example, in the school system. And I don't think we talk about that as much as we should do.
I'm still finding it hard to accept that your colleagues didn't support you and other teachers, because it could be them next, you know. We're seeing it here. And it's not just on that issue as well. It's on issues around multiculturalism and immigration. We're seeing that the debate is being shut down because people who are asking questions about it are being labelled as racist or hateful, and they are being marginalised.
But we talk to each other, but not when somebody here.
Right.
Yeah. So people are afraid to say their opinion, but they have the opinions anyway.
Because expressing that opinion might see them isolated from society, right?
Yes, that's it.
And do you see a problem? I see a problem with this new world where everybody lives on the internet. We are on the internet 4, 5, 6 hours a day, and the internet has become, you know, where we live, where we dwell. And more and more people are scared of or frightened of saying what they really think in case they are isolated or cast out or sent into exile. Do you see that as a problem, the internet?
Yes, I do. And you can see it with the young people. They are absorbed by internet, but they are also, we are surveyed, we can be watched and checked out for everything we tweet, we say on social media. If there were not for internet, this had never happened to me. No way. It's only because of internet, because I expressed my opinions on social media, so everybody could see it and they could report it. So it's the internet is a dangerous weapon for those who wants to.
Yeah, this is a new. This is a new phenomenon, isn't it?
This
Twitter storm, where a group of people, usually so-called progressives, can demand that somebody is silenced, and then the third party, in your case, it was your school, they acquiesce or they give in to the demands from the very loud minority. And they are a minority, but they're very loud. These are dangerous times. A lot of comments coming in. I'm being asked to ask you, do you think there is an agenda to blur the natural lines between male and female roles to kind of weaken society? Do you see that happening?
Frankly, I've seen it, and I've been thinking that it could be like that many, many times. I don't want to think that it is that way. But of course, I've been wondering myself, maybe, I don't know. They are very successful in that way, because the young people are now being so confused. They suffer from anxiety, mental illness. They don't know who they are. Gender dysphoria is increasing. Boys are staying in their homes, watching YouTube, internet, lost their friends and social life, and girls are being afraid. And it is weakening our society.
I'm very surprised, I'm surprised that parents allow their young children to learn about gender issues and sexuality. I don't have children, but if I did, I would be outraged. I would be angry that my children's minds were being interfered with like this. Isn't it a huge surprise that parents are not demanding answers on this?
It is, and I'm being a parent myself, and I didn't notice that for my own children until it was too late. Then I realized what they were, what they had been through. That there is a propaganda in school for making children gender neutral, and they aren't. I have one daughter and one boy, and they are different. They were not only raised different, but they are born different. My boy is, he acts like a boy and thinks like a boy, and my daughter acts like a girl. It's natural. But I didn't notice that when they were in school. So I think many parents don't know what's going on in school.
That's interesting. They don't know what's going on. But as it becomes more common, it will be difficult to hide it from parents. Do you think if parents knew, or if they find out, do you think there might be a reaction?
Yes, I think the reaction will come someday. But until now, it has been seen as something good, that everyone should adopt that way of thinking. So I think many parents believe that this is the good thing for the children. Everyone can choose their own gender. But now they are finding out that that was not quite a good idea.
It's confusing the children. When I watched your interview today, which is brilliant, it's a brilliant interview. I'm going to tweet a link to it. The presenter and you, both of you, are incredible. The presenter is a brilliant, he's a brilliant guy. He did a great job. You said something that really fascinated me. You said that, now correct me if I misquote you, because I might do, but you said that when immigrants come to Sweden, they are prepared to integrate. They come with open minds, but something else prevents them from integrating. Did I quote you right? Did you say that?
Yes, I said something like that.
Brilliant.
And that is true.
How? Explain this. This is fascinating thinking. So the immigrant arrives, it could be from the Middle East, it could be an Arab, yes, it could be from anywhere. That man or woman wants to become Swedish, to embrace Swedish culture. But you said something else gets in the way. What is it?
Because the Swedish people, the Swedes, are not standing up for their own culture. And it's like meeting nothing at all. The immigrant is trying to find out what is Swedish, what is the norms here, what are the social codes. They exist under the surface, but Swedish acts like that we have no culture, we have nothing. Here you can be what you want, you can keep your own culture, your own way of living and thinking and so on. So if you meet just a vacuum, you don't know what to integrate in.
And do you think that the progressive multicultural agenda that we have seen, not just in Sweden but elsewhere, has that basically eliminated culture? Has it removed culture, Anneli?
In several ways, but it can't be it can't be successful, because there are still people here who have it in their bloods, in their veins. So you can't take it away totally. But we are weakened. We have no national identity. We have no gender identity. We have no pride of being the Swedish people with our own history, our own culture, and so on. So it's kind of self-hate sometimes. You don't estimate yourself here.
And that's as a result of the changes in education over the years, the changes in news reporting. Do you think television programming, do you think that's got something to do with it?
Yes, maybe. Well, I think so. But it has been so slow.
Gradual.
Yeah, gradual. So we didn't notice until now. Now we see the result. But I think this has been going on for quite a long time. So we have been weakened as a society, as a culture, as a people for a very long, long time. And the new generation, the young people, now we can see it with them. But I think in some way that they will come back and they will fight back one day and there will be a backlash.
That's very interesting that we're talking about the kind of gradual erasing of culture. I did speak last year with an academic from Kent University. You may have heard of him, Annalie. His name is Frank Furedi. And he believes that we're seeing an end result now, because for the last maybe 20 years, maybe longer, minority cultures are getting precedence over the majority indigenous national culture. And it isn't the fault of the minority, which you have said. You say that the immigrant comes to Sweden, maybe comes to London with an open mind and wants to integrate. But when they arrive, there isn't anything here because of the gradual changes we've seen over the years. Furedi basically says that when you promote the rights of minority cultures at the expense of the majority, you do see these problems that we're seeing now. And that's, do you understand? Do you go along with that?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I share that point of view. I think that is exactly a good description of what has been happening here in Sweden.
And then,
yes.
Sorry to interrupt, and then people blame the minority, which is foolish, because it isn't the fault of the minority. It's the fault of the people behind the agenda who've decided to make it. So tell me this, before, because we're going to run out of time, and I've really enjoyed having you on, Annalie. Thanks for giving us your time today. And you're welcome back any time to talk about these issues, by the way. What do we do about this? How, if teachers with an open mind like you are being fired and are leaving education, what are we going to do to try to reverse this and to, you know, to get children to think for themselves, to have open minds and not to kind of, you know, fall into identity politics? What are we going to do about it?
We must keep on standing of what we believe in and what is natural and what we feel inside ourselves that this is the right thing. We must make next generation more stronger, proud of themselves, proud of being a boy or a man, a girl or a woman. We must start with ourselves and don't give up and don't follow the rest who is trying to weaken the society. That ain't going to work. I hope not.
Do you know, Annalie, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the program today. I mean that. It's been great. Thanks for doing it as well. Very short notice. I've tweeted a link to where people can find you on Twitter. Annalie is a French and Swedish teacher, a vastly experienced high school teacher with some very, very well briefed opinions on this agenda, which is very serious. Thanks so much for your time today, Annalie, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Brilliant stuff. Thanks a lot. Live on the line from Söderköping, I hope I said that right, in southeast Sweden today. Very brave woman. I was reading about her today and the rubbish that she had to deal with 3 years ago when she took some students to a feminist rally or a feminist debate, and they asked questions of the feminists and challenged their ideas, and that started a Twitter storm, a hate campaign against her, which ultimately resulted in her losing her job. Terrific lady. and we will invite her back again. And you heard her on Monday's Richie Allen Show, live on richieallen.co.uk, triggerwarning.tv, Fab Radio 2, and Tune In Radio. Nothing like it. It is exactly a minute to the top of the hour. Let's take a very quick break, back in a minute. Don't forget, Scott Rickard joins the programme soon.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markmajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Right, welcome back to the programme. Scott Rickard joins us in a couple of minutes' time. We're looking forward to that. You can tweet to me at any time during the course of the next hour. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. I was about to do something silly there. There is a lot to be said for Mondays and making mistakes, but maybe I'll be all right. I thought I had. Yeah, yeah, I have. Yes, I've timed it right. I've timed it right. Before we get Scott on, we're going to have a quick jaunt across to FSN to get the latest headlines. Are we? Are we? No? We are? Be Jesus. Do you know, it's a Monday thing, isn't it? I could be singing Monday all day long. Oh, be God, right? Have we got the headlines? No, we don't. Do we? Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to wait for the headlines to come to me. Is what I'm going to do. It is Monday the 21st of May, 2018. It is a balmy night in Manchester. Another beautiful day, but we got some heavy rain late in the afternoon, and it has left things very humid. It is very humid in the great city. And in fact, it's incredibly warm in the city. It's incredibly warm in the studio right now. He says, as he is filling. I have tweeted out Annalise's Twitter handle. Do follow her. She's a fascinating lady. Fascinating story, that. Just by the grace of God today, I was looking for spokespeople, a spokeswoman or a spokesman who'd been affected by this, these issues, by taking on this agenda, and I came across Annalise and a brilliant interview that she did with a fellow Swede, which is on YouTube. And as I said, and I'm good to my word, I will tweet a link out to it before the programme ends tonight. All right, I think we can go to FSN now for the headlines. Is it Rebecca Foster?
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the White House is preparing to target Iran with the strongest sanctions in history. President Donald Trump says China has agreed to buy massive amounts of additional agricultural products from the U.S. And the first official royal wedding photos have been released after Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's marriage.
Yeah, the royal wedding, what a load of, yeah. 3 minutes past the hour then. Those were the headlines. Thanks to Rebecca Foster, Scott Rickard in a couple of minutes' time. Got some terrific guests lined up for you this week as well throughout the week. Monday to Thursday, 7 p.m. UK time, that's British summertime, and 11 a.m. on Sundays, yesterday being the exception. I thank you again. Let's move on then.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Oh yeah. Right, while we dial up Scott, we'll have some Dire Straits and Sultans of Swing on your Richie Allen Show, live in Manchester. The time is exactly 4 minutes past the hour.
It's a shiver in the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime, sound of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time.
Music from Dire Straits, Sultans of Swing on the Richie Allen Show, 8 minutes past the hour. Monday's programme, welcome to it if you're just joining me into the second hour. Terrific conversation in hour one with a great lady, Annalie Khubai. Don't, if you missed that, don't miss the podcast. which is always online 15 minutes after the live show concludes. We are live now. Let's welcome back to the programme. I'm delighted that he pops in and joins us regularly. He's a terrific geopolitical analyst and historian. He's been seen everywhere, Press TV, RT, Sputnik and many others. Veterans for Peace in his time as well. Let's welcome back to the show our own Scott Rickard. Scott, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back, Richie.
Thanks for coming on. Delighted that you do come on so often. We're proud to have you on. You've been in the Far East recently, by the way. Tell us about that. What were you doing out there?
Well, I was just vacationing, but I got to tell you, and actually running into some old colleagues as well, but I had a good time to go out and meet a lot of people and basically do a lot of personal investigation on historical events in Thailand and Malaysia. Spent most of my time in Thailand, but came across some interesting stories that I had some interest in and some history on, especially the Jim Thompson story. I don't know how familiar you are with him, but definitely a guy who was much like Graham Fuller and the work he did in the Caspian Sea. Jim Thompson did quite a bit of work in Thailand for the CIA post-World War II and was very instrumental in not only developing the silk industry, but also developing the opium trade out of Burma through Thailand alongside the CIA and the U.S. military.
That sounds fascinating. I don't know very much about that, Scott. That's something that we should maybe cover in a future program. I didn't mention in the introduction, but I should have done, Scott's a former linguist at the National Security Agency. Hence, he's in very high demand to provide geopolitical analysis in a lot of places. Delighted that he's back on. A couple of things that we have to get into, Israel being one of them. You may have noticed today, Scott, you might not, but a cartoonist at the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung was fired today because he drew a caricature of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, the cartoon wasn't in any way racist. It wasn't in any way defamatory. It was referencing what happened in Gaza during the Nakba remembrance, of course, but also referencing the Eurovision Song Contest. There was a Twitter storm, apparently, and this 85-year-old cartoonist has been fired. You've been covering this a long time. You've been watching it. I suppose you're not surprised, Scott, that somebody is critical of Benjamin Netanyahu, even though it's mild criticism, and he loses his job.
Well, unfortunately, this has been the status quo, not just with this cartoonist, but obviously several cartoonists have been fired for similar purposes, when in fact you're looking at a extremely hypocritical role here when you're talking about Israel. I obviously, if there was a concentration camp of 2 million people in the world today that was filled with people of the Jewish faith, and the average age was 19, and half of the people were under the age of 18, I think you'd see quite an outcry globally for the freedom of those people being held.
Right, Scott is just breaking up a bit on us there.
A concentration camp, or what I refer to as the Gaza.
The reception is pretty bad there, so I'll tell you what we're going to do. We'll just briefly disconnect there and reconnect, and hopefully we'll get Scott back and it'll sound a bit better than that. There was a bit of background noise there, but it was okay. We could hear him pretty well, but there was quite a bit of background noise there on the call, which was a bit disconcerting. So I know he's on a hands-free device in Florida there, so I'm calling him back. We'll give him a second. In fact, I'll ask him to call me. That might be the way to go about it. This is the Richie Allen Show, by the way. It is exactly 13 minutes past the hour. Scott Rickard is our guest. He's in Tampa in Florida. There was a wee bit of scratchiness on the call there. It was dropping in and out, so I've just disconnected it, and hopefully we'll be able to get him back in a second. radio. He's typing to me now. There might be a problem. So in the meantime, we'll take some music. This is pretty bizarre, this. Eh? This is taking you back. Way back.
Love is in the air. Everywhere I look around. Love is in the air. Every sight and every sound. And I don't know if I'm being foolish. Don't know if I'm being wise. But it's something that I must believe in. And it's there when I look in your eyes. Love is in the air. In the whisper of the trees.
Right, as brilliant as John Paul Young is, we'll cut him short because I think we've got Scott back and it might be a better line. Sorry about that, Scott. Welcome back.
Hey, so sorry about that. Skype on the mobile is not so good.
No problems. It sounds considerably better now, so it's good. Yeah, we were talking about the perils of criticising the Israeli government and the German cartoonist being fired. 85 years old, he wouldn't apologise for it, he stuck to his guns, and you were talking, you were basically responding to that, so we'll start there again, Scott, go ahead.
Well, basically what it comes down to is, you know, given the turn of events, as if the Israelis were 2 million in population with an average age of 19 years old in an open-air prison, or the Gaza ghetto, as I like to refer to it as, very much like the Warsaw ghetto. These people are prisoners in their own country and have also been, unfortunately, put down for now 70 years. You know, I like to call it the crystal Nakba. You know, if you want to really refer to what's happened here in Israel, you know, they've turned around and acting just like their captors under Nazi Germany, and it is absolutely an apartheid state. And this is unfortunate that they have such influence on media industry and on our political infrastructure that you really can't speak badly about any of the political affairs, or you're considered something, as they're referring to this cartoonist, as an anti-Semite. I have been labeled an anti-Semite by the Anti-Defamation League in the United States, and they refused to respond to any of my my mail or any of my emails or my phone calls, and certainly don't give me a chance to defend myself in any way whatsoever. So I think what we see here is a very unfortunate event where you have tremendous amounts of influence on media and political infrastructure that is absolutely biased, and certainly not open-minded and not thoughtful in any way whatsoever of the victims in this scenario, where we have literally millions that have suffered for decades in Palestine, and also certainly the refugees in the surrounding countries. So this is an incredibly unfortunate event in human history, and sadly it is not uncommon. Certainly, Great Britain has been responsible for it, for famines that they caused in Bengal, famines that they caused in Ireland, and certainly the United States has been responsible for it for just a multitude of deaths in Africa, Southeast Asia, and even the Korean Peninsula. So this is as well as the indigenous people of the North American continent, the millions that died in that genocide as well. It's a sad state of affairs. It's unfortunately very common with the human race, and sadly, the white really genocidal colonialism continues today.
And the Gaza thing, of course, I shouldn't say that. I don't mean the Gaza thing, but the conditions in Gaza, our refusal to deal with Israel, as in our government's refusal to deal with what is a pariah state, they love to use the word regime to describe any government they don't like. I was watching Sky News today again and the BBC, they kept referring to Tehran as the regime, this nonsense. The real regime in the region is in Israel. But Scott, on the punishment for criticising them, you might not be aware, you might be, but in the last couple of hours, the former mayor of London, Ken Livingston, who for many years has been a Labour Party very outspoken critic of the Israeli regime and the Israeli crimes. Ken Livingston, a couple of years ago, mentioned that there was a time when Hitler supported Zionism, which is true. Of course, the Havre Agreement, 1933, whatever it was. But that's caused a lot of problems for Livingston in the last couple of years. And today, he has left the Labour Party, saying that even though he was right to cite the historic events of 1933, it's probably best for the Labour Party if I leave. And the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has come out and said, oh yeah, it's for the best. But Scott, what he said was factually accurate. How dangerous is it when people make historically accurate statements and then have to leave their jobs or leave their parties just to keep people happy and just to appease the Israeli regime? These are tyrannical times, Scott.
Well, they're not tyrannical times if you look at history. Unfortunately, they've been pretty much status quo since really the emergence of Zionism in the late 1800s. And then the dominance after the support for the Bolsheviks and the Kazakhs and their overthrow of the Tsars. So you've had the relationship between the Zionist entity, which is, you know, nothing more than the political infrastructure that emerged out of Odessa, Ukraine, and now has become a dominant player in the financial, political, and media infrastructures around the world. And, you know, I'm very disappointed in Jerry Corbyn. In the past, he was much like George Galloway. He was very outspoken of the apartheid regime in Israel. So I would say, you know, shame on you, Jeremy, for, you know, saying it would be the right thing to do. Certainly in the past, Jeremy Corbyn has been far running the reasonable and factual operations on the ground. In fact, he even worked for a short stint for Press TV in the past. Don't forget that. Just very much like George Galloway. So I'm very disappointed that Jeremy Corbyn would come out and say something like that. It's discouraging that once you become a member of the elite political infrastructure, you become far more softcore Zionist than you should. And I think people do that as a way to not only further their political careers, but also to gain momentum on agendas that they'd like to complete in their during their term. And sadly, it's a huge sacrifice to sacrifice your honor and your and certainly the personal endeavors of individuals to be truthful and seek justice for all. That's pretty much what I stand for. You know, obviously, in the United States and certainly even in countries that I do support, that most people are against, Iran and other countries, when they do wrong, you know, obviously everyone should be held accountable.
That's a really good thing to say, Scott. Thanks for that. Scott Rickard is our guest. He's live on the line from Florida. It's interesting you said that about Iran, because there are things, Scott, that happen in countries like Iran that I wouldn't be thrilled about, that I wouldn't be happy about. Yet, I've been making programs like this for about 10, 12 years now. Before that, I was mainstream reporter, mainstream producer. And Iran is no threat to the security of the region. Iran is no threat to peace anywhere. It hasn't attacked any country for hundreds of years. In fact, Iran has been the victim. It was the victim of a coup in 1953. It was the victim of the Iraq-Iran war, when the American regime gave weapons to the Iraqis to try and destroy Iran with. But of course, there are things that happen in Iran, human rights issues, that we shouldn't ever ignore. And maybe in the past, some journalists so-called independent journalists have supported Iran but have not been prepared to acknowledge that there's no such thing as a dystopia. There's no such thing as a perfect country. It's good to hear that. With respect to what we saw, last week, and the mass murder of Palestinians using these horrendous bullets, these horrendous these snipers killing these people, I don't want to sound negative, but isn't it just another example of Israel committing mass murder, and they're just going to get away with it, Scott? Right? Who's going to stand up to the plate and say enough's enough? We've got to sanction this regime back to the Stone Age. I don't see it happening. Over to you.
Well, I don't see it happening either. Obviously, you know, the most outspoken individual is Erdogan from Turkey. But at the same time, he's not putting his money where his mouth is. They still, you know, Turkey does around $350 billion worth of trade with Israel. And Turkey could easily put their money where their mouth is and basically boycott and stop all businesses. All they've done is really whitewashed it, the issue, by and appeasing the Islamists in Turkey by basically cutting off diplomatic ties. Certainly that's nothing compared to economic ties when we look at the success of bringing down apartheid in South Africa. But I mean, to further, you know, when you look at the issue here, you know, to further the statement with Iran, you really have a country that is a good example of the kinds of diplomatic corruption. You know, you brought up the overthrow of Mossadegh, but you can go all the way back to the 1800s under Reuters. And this is very significant because Reuters also put a puppet in place in the 1800s and bought all the natural resources. This was before the founding of oil and the beginning of the what became the British petroleum industry. And this is a very serious event that people really need to realize, is that not only was Reuters very significant in manipulating the media since the print set typewriters came out, or printers came out, you also have someone who's also been very significant at controlling natural resources for now almost a full 200 years when it comes to the petroleum industry. But certainly prior to that, there were the wood industry was extremely important to the world economy at the time. So it's really economic warfare that continues today. And that economic warfare is the only thing that has really been effective in overthrowing regimes. And if you really want to overthrow the United States government's really hegemony in the region, you have to get global consensus on the economic hitmen that could actually happen. That in the United States, we're talking about players even today. The country of India is doing a tit for tat with American tariffs on Indian steel and Indian aluminum. The country of India has decided that they're going to put tariffs on American products going into India. So these are minor steps. But when it comes to the major steps, unfortunately, India, much like the United States, is very tied to the British Empire, very much like Israel as well. These are really extensions of the success of the British Empire, and they are absolutely constricted by the financial, I'd say, dominance of the Western banking infrastructure. This is only a 250-year-old system. It certainly dominates all the NATO partners and their allies, and they maintain a financial sort of upper hand against the BRICS nations or any nation that operates outside of that banking infrastructure. And that's the economic side of this that really controls our politicians. I mean, our politicians are really nothing more than puppets. Certainly in the United States, the American politicians and the ones we've elected really haven't represented the American people in well over 150 years because of the types of relationships that the financial institutions took over with the American political system. And certainly England's not immune to that either.
Do you go along with Dean Henderson, I know you know Dean. Dean is, like yourself, he's a regular guest.
Fantastic.
He's a lovely guy, Dean. By the way, just to catch up with our listeners who might be just joining the programme, yes, you are listening to Scott Rickard on the line from Florida. Terrific to have Scott back on. He is a former NSA linguist. He's a historian. His knowledge of geopolitical history is astonishing, even to a history graduate like myself. I think he's brilliant. Not only that, but he's a regular contributor to many media organisations. Dean reckons, I mean, we're talking about the financial elites that have been controlling things through the ages. Do you go along with Dean that all roads lead to the City of London?
London has been massively influential for the last 500 years. Prior to that, you know, you have to go obviously to Rome and Prussia. You know, I'm one of these people that believe the war between the Romans and the Prussians never really ended. It just diversified, and they combined their efforts alongside the French to basically disintegrate the Spanish. At this point, you know, you had a bit of participation more recently between Italy and the, the Prussian side has always been certainly the northern northeastern Europeans, and certainly the Russians. But at the same time, these were some of the most successful battle-hardened warriors in the history of Europe, alongside the Germans. The Germans and the Prussians, obviously, when they combined efforts because of their efforts against the Russians, they certainly had a good effort at that. You know, if you look at the Polish Empire and how successful it was as well, so. Obviously, you know, when you're talking about the all roads lead to London, we're really only talking about the last five centuries. Certainly when it comes to what they call now in the intelligence community the Five Eyes, these are the key players of the, the London financiers that, you know, think about it. The United States. We are the largest borrower in the history of the world, but at the same time, we're the largest manufacturer of weapons and the largest consumer and obviously the largest distributor in the history of the world. The Third Reich couldn't hold a candle to what the United States are doing, and obviously the United States did it with the help of Third Reich, given the influence of all the engineers and certainly all the scientists and all of the intelligence community that the United States imported under Operation Paperclip, when they brought in all of the former Third Reich Nazi Germany professionals to assimilate into the American military and intelligence infrastructure.
And it never went away.
We really have... Go ahead.
No, sorry to butt in. The Third Reich, of course, never went away. It never disintegrated. It just changed shape.
The United States is basically the Fourth Reich.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott Rickard
alongside the British, though.
Alongside the British. Scott Rickard is our guest. Scott, Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela has won another six-year term. Obviously, the foreign offices of the United States and of the United Kingdom are saying they don't recognize his election success. There are two trains of thought on Venezuela, on Chavez and on Maduro. Mine is obvious, but the two trends of thought are, one, Venezuela is a basket case, the leaders are crazy, this is proof that socialism doesn't work. And the other train of thought is, of course, that external dark and deep forces have basically sought to destroy the possibility of success in Venezuela. Which is true, Scott?
Well, they're both true. I mean, obviously, when it comes to, the concept of socialism or capitalism or any kind of financial infrastructure, it really comes down to the corruption of the government. If you look at the same time, the outside influences and, the kinds of activities that the United States and their allies have conducted, not only in Venezuela, but certainly Ukraine, obviously Syria. It can go many horrific ways. It can go from the economic sanctions that have crippled nations in the past. Certainly the economic sanctions against Venezuela have been massively effective at causing failure in any economic infrastructure they're trying to conduct. Certainly the, any kind of cooperation from the West when it comes to economic conditions with massive loans, military aid, certainly cooperative business infrastructure. Countries like Japan and Korea and Germany and Israel, they've profited greatly from that kind of economic cooperation. So it really comes down to the kinds of cooperation. And when you get into the economic warfare, very few nations have the ability to be successful, obviously because of the inability to compete both internationally and the inability to supply a simple macroeconomics to your society. You can only produce so much in your own country. Certainly trade is what absolutely advances our societies. And when you cut that trade off, you immediately put the, cramp down on the umbilical cord. And certainly anything is that is denied the ability to feed itself is going to fail. And so I say, the economics is a huge player in how the Americans and their allies have squeezed countries. Look what they did to Iraq. Look what they've been doing, unfortunately, to North Korea for 60 years. By the way, the longest economic sanctions in the history of modern times, North Korea. And this is a country that, they call out as a regime when, in fact, over 6 million people were murdered on that small strip of land, peninsula. And, the Americans came out with many colloquialisms that are just horrific. Carpet bombing, gook came from that. That's why they referred to the Asian individuals, because the main American was Migook. And as they were attacking Americans, they were yelling Migook. And then the Americans were obviously picking them off one by one, killing and murdering well over 5 million on that small peninsula alone. So, and that's where the word carpet bomb came from. More bombs were dropped on North Korea than in the entire World War II. So it's just let's be clear here. The true aggressors and the history of this world, the Americans will be looked upon, thousands of years from now as very similar to the conquistadors.
This is great stuff, Scott. One of the things I do enjoy most about speaking with you is how we segue into these areas. It's brilliant stuff. It really is. I'm not just saying that. I mean that sincerely. Let me put this to you.
Thank
because
you so much.
No, I mean it, Scott. I don't know what I am. I don't identify as anything. I don't identify as a socialist or a liberal or a conservative. But look, I certainly would be a big supporter of the ideas of Hugo Chavez. And I want to touch on something. I want to touch on something you said a minute ago, because I think you're right. And I think it pains me to admit that you're right. Not because I have any problems with you being right, but Chavez had great but Chavez had great success early on after renationalizing the country's energy resources, and was able to show a big improvement in bringing people out of poverty. Quality of life definitely improved there, but it began to slow down round about the last couple of years, 2012, 2013, 14. I would say, you see, the mainstream media says it slowed down because what he was doing was unsustainable. But I would say that things began to get difficult because of these external influences, because of these market controls and sanctions that you describe. So here's my... Now, you might disagree with that, and if you do, by all means, jump right in. But my question would be then, if countries like Venezuela, renationalizing, kicking out the traitors and the globalists and the foreign enemies, if they can't get past the sanctions and the trade restrictions, surely all that's left for countries like Venezuela is to go to war. Do you know where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I don't agree with the go to war part.
I don't want anybody to go to war. Don't get me wrong. Jesus Christ. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. No, I don't want anybody to go to war. But I'm saying, what else could you do? Go ahead.
Well, so what the benefit that they have now and what they didn't have in the last almost decade was the benefit of the price of the barrel. Now, remember, the price of the barrel has been killed deliberately. And you said it, you hit it square on the head. It was the control of the market, of the oil market, that was absolutely destructive to Venezuela. Now, with the barrel rolling back up, the Venezuelans will have a fighting chance. Certainly under Chavez, they had a much better chance. The price of the barrel, my God, it skyrocketed. I think it got up to as high as $130, $140 a barrel.
It did.
So, you know, that was a much more easy economic community to be profitable at that time. So, you know, you're producing a product that was four to five times more valuable than what Maduro had over the past few years. So it certainly does. When you talk about the control of the market, that's an absolute key. That's a key player. They've been playing that game against the Russians. They've been playing that game against the Iranians. And certainly right now, because of the downfall of the economic community in the West, they can't afford to play it anymore. And so you see the price of oil once again skyrocketing. And I think we're up to almost $80, $90 a barrel again.
Yeah, we're seeing petrol prices, gasoline prices, of course, as you'd say back home, rise sharply in the last month or so here, sadly for me and for everybody else. Scott Rickard is our guest, folks. We've got another 5 minutes with Scott. He's a busy man. Great to have him on. Scott, we'll finish with this. The Syrian government is saying that it's finally taken full control of Damascus and the surrounding areas. How significant is that news, Scott?
Well, it's fantastic news. I mean, here you have really a success story of a country that combined efforts with several other countries to push back a Western, really mercenary war, a proxy war that was placed upon it. And it was extremely difficult for the Syrians to do this. When you look at some of the underground infrastructure that was built by the quote-unquote ISIS, you know, they give these mercenaries some of the most, villainous personas in order to, vilify their activities and make them look like they're unsophisticated, when in fact they're supported by some of the most sophisticated military tactics and military logistics and military engineering and infrastructure that the world has ever seen. And the fact that the Syrians were able to fight off a multinational NATO-backed force that had partners out of the Persian Gulf and had partners from around the world, even out of Libya, and certainly, unfortunately, former Irish CIA operatives. When you look at Mahdi El-Harati, whose wife, by the way, was caught with 500,000 euros in Ireland that were stolen from her, that the CIA had paid her husband to overthrow Gaddafi. You know, these are the types of players that Syria and the Russians, the Iranians and the Hezbollah were able to fight off. You know, you're talking about a true David and Goliath story. Certainly the Russians were very, my hat's off to them. I mean, it's heroism in the modern day. You know, when you talk about the Russians, they've had to put up with World War One, World War Two, Afghanistan, and now Syria. You know, this is the West attacking the Russians. And obviously prior to that, you had the Trotsky and his notorious individuals going after the Czars. You know, the British, the Swedes, and now the Americans have joined that allyship, and the French are participating friends, have really controlled this planet for a long time. And it's the first time in my lifetime that you've had any kind of success against the true imperialist regime that runs this planet. And it's good to see. And I hope people start to, I don't want to see the fall, and I'm not calling for the fall of England or the fall of the United States. I don't want the countries to be overthrown, but I want them to act legitimately. And I wanted to take this as a message and say, look, your countries have been acting illegitimately for quite a long time here. It's time to play fairly and pay nicely in this world.
Brilliant way to end it today, Scott. Thanks for your time again today. Do come back anytime you want, my friend. When you've got something to say, just give us a message and come back on the show. Always love having you. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me again.
It's an honour. Scott Rickard, live on the line there from Tampa, Florida. By the way, you can follow Scott on Twitter. It's at Scott underscore Rickard, R-I-C-K-A-R-D. That's at Scott underscore Rickard, former NSA linguist and a regular contributor to Sputnik, to RT, to Press TV and many others. Top man. Check him out. Really interesting stuff there. It is 15 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Quick break, back with your comments and more in a minute.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structure and application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Welcome back. Yeah, top man Scott Rickard. That's we're not over yet. We've still got plenty of time. But things have flown by this evening. Monday it is, the 21st of May 2018. I had a message earlier from a Lucinda, who I've never heard from before, sent me a tweet, Lucinda, earlier on to say, relatively new listener to the programme, wanted me to know that she is delighted to see the end of... I thought this is quite funny. Glad, I saw your tweet about the FA Cup final, Richie, on Saturday. I'm delighted that the football is over now till August. It's not, though. That's the thing. It ain't over. You have the World Cup in Russia beginning in just over 3 weeks, is it, from now? Not that I'll be spending a lot of time watching that, to be fair. And I don't spend very much time watching football anyway. It is a nice escape every now and then. But, yeah, don't be too excited about the end of the season. There's no end of the season in World Cup year, Lucinda. Tweet the programme. It's at Richie Allen Show. That's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Load of comments about this royal wedding and symbolism. Now, I'm no expert in symbolism. My introduction to symbolism was it's not that many years ago, but about, what are we now, 2018? I suppose about 10 years ago, I spoke to Jordan Maxwell. It wasn't the first time I'd spoken to him, but it was the third or fourth time, and he talked at length about symbolism, the importance of symbolism. So anybody who's followed or read Jordan Maxwell or David Icke, as well, it must be said, Jim Mars, they've done a lot of work on symbolism. And I had an email or two, it must be said, over the last day or two to ask about, well, Richie, did you notice all the symbolism? Well, first of all, I didn't watch it. That's the truth. I didn't watch it. Jesus wept. I hardly sat there and watched that shit. What I did see, late on Saturday evening, when I watched the late evening BBC News, I obviously was subjected to brief highlights of it. And I was three sheets to the wind by then, having watched the aforementioned FA Cup final. Now, that being said, when I switched on the BBC News at 9 or 10, whatever it was, the ITV News at 10 as well, symbolism did occur to me, but I couldn't see very far in front of my face. So help me out. Was there a lot of occult symbolism on display? Obviously, there would have been inside the church, obviously, at the Windsor. Was it Windsor Castle, right? Whatever. Windsor Cathedral, was it? I don't know. I'm sure there was plenty of it there. But in terms of the clothes, the costumes, the photographs later on, I'm sure it was absolutely full of symbolism and occult symbology. But I couldn't give you any specific examples, is what I'm saying. But I'm sure there are members of our audience who particularly focus on that, who do. Now, David Stanford, on the Chavez Venezuela thing, Nicolas Maduro. Richie, a country cannot be seen to be successful and self-sufficient without the World Bank and the cabal. Dare I say that prompted the Second World War, said David. Well, thanks for that, David. With respect to Maduro, yes, it's my belief. Now, very good guests, great guests on this programme, like Jeff Berwick, of course, the dollar vigilante, great guy, very smart guy, would profoundly disagree with me. But I'm not stubborn, but I've not seen any evidence that suggests that Chavez and then laterally Maduro have basically fucked the Venezuelan economy. You know, if you read the broadsheet newspapers today in this country, after you get past all the royal family bullshit, you come to stories about Maduro's victory, how it's been deemed illegitimate by the likes of, as I said, the foreign departments, the foreign offices here and in America. And all the stories contain these stories about supermarkets that are empty, food shortages and all of that. It's the same stuff every time you read about Venezuela. I would argue that the market controls that I talked about, and Scott Rickard, though he wasn't entirely in agreement with me, acknowledged the manipulation of the oil prices, put a huge dent in the plans of the Venezuelan government to use oil revenues to basically try and end severe poverty in that country, to get children into schools, to get people out of the gutter, which they were doing. So I go along with David Stanford. That's what happens. You have these external pressures which make it next to impossible. Scott said, and he's right whether you like to admit it or not, that you cannot exist today without trading relationships with other countries. You're contradicting yourself there, Richie, because you've often said on this programme, well, we should make our own steel, we should do this, we should do that. Yes, we should. We shouldn't be buying steel in from India or anywhere else, a cheap steel, undercutting steel producers in our own countries. No, we shouldn't, of course. But these things are made difficult by factors beyond the control of those steel manufacturers and beyond the control of those governments. We're talking, of course, about market manipulation by the elites. That's why I asked them the question. If you're in the situation Venezuela is in, I don't want anybody to be going to war with anybody, and I'm not endorsing it. I'm a pacifist. But surely a country that's under the boot like Venezuela, its only option is to declare war on the United States of America or on other countries that are condemning it to the situation that it finds itself in. Now, that's a laughable idea. Of course Venezuela can't declare war on the United States or anywhere else. It would be obliterated. Obliterated. But what's left? If you're Maduro, what do you do? Chavez. Because had Chavez not been given cancer by whomever gave him cancer, never believed that he died of cancer brought on by I don't know, by his lifestyle or whatever the hell. If Chavez had lived, he would be dealing with the same nonsense Maduro is dealing with now. What would he do? You know? But there are people who listen to this program, free market capitalists, who believe that that I'm wrong and that guys like Chavez is wrong and the ideas of Bolivar are wrong and they can't work. And maybe they're right. Maybe they can't work because you've got to eliminate the city of London. You've got to eliminate Frankfurt. You've got to eliminate the Rothschild, Rockefeller, Warburg, cabal that manipulate all these things that make it impossible for countries to do for themselves, for countries to thrive by nationalising their own resources, by using their own resources for the betterment of their people. In today's financial model, it can't work. Kills me to say that, 'cause I'd be a huge supporter of Chavez. I did a Sunday View last year, the whole hour about Chavez and why he was a success and why that could be a success, but also why it can't be, as long as we are basically hooked up by some umbilical cord to the financial system that we are all hooked up to, which is currencies controlled by a tiny elite, a tiny group of families, money controlled by these same families. I mean, the Venezuelan currency is worthless, which is devastating for them now. But Scott said, and this is very interesting, of course, because he's got another 6 years now, Maduro. With what's happened in Syria, with the threatened collapse of the Iranian nuclear deal, that pushed oil prices higher, which again would suit Venezuela and would suit Russia. Anyway, we're going to leave it there. There are people who are very well versed in this. I will get them on the programme to talk about it and argue with me about it. So we'll do that. Right, that was pretty much it then for Monday's programme. Like I said, I've got some really interesting guests lined up for you this week. Follow the programme on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook, nor will I ever be again. My personal Facebook page is now gone. It isn't there. I did get some emails from people asking me, why did you delete me on Facebook? And cretins, listen to me. The madness of people. Why did you delete me on Facebook? I didn't delete anybody. I deleted my page. I'm gone. That's why you can't find me on Facebook. I'm gone. There is a Richie Allen Show Facebook page. It's there. Facebook.com/The Richie Allen Show. But I've got nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. When I tweet things, some things will appear on there, like links to podcasts and the programme. But it's not monitored by me. I've nowt to do with it, all right? But it's still there. I don't know for how long, but it's still there in the meantime. Anyway, okay. Right, yes, we've got some. Have I? Yes, I have. Right, okay. That's it. Back with you tomorrow at 7 p.m. In the meantime, just a quick thank you to Simon Stewart for looking after the YouTube channel. Thank you, Simon. That's very interesting, by the way. We put a new YouTube channel on in February. My YouTube channel had 80,000 subscribers. It was deleted like that in the blink of an eye. In February, we launched a new one. We asked, could we place ads on our interviews? They said only if you reach 1,000 subscribers and only when you have 4,000 hours of listening. Well, within a week, we had more than 1,000 subscribers and we had more than 4,000 hours of listening. That was in February. It is now the 21st of May and YouTube refuses. Even though we have a Google AdSense monetization account, they refuse to allow us to place ads against our videos. They keep telling us it's in limbo, it's in some sort of stasis, we've got a backlog, we'll get back to you at some stage in the future. This is dreadful. But look, it's their right, they can do what they want, it's their company. But I think we've now got 12,000 plus subscribers and they won't allow us to monetize the videos. Surprise, surprise. Look after yourselves and one another. See you tomorrow, Tuesday at 7. Going to leave you with some Reverend Al Green then to close out today's programme. Massive thanks to my guests, by the way. Thank you to Anna Lee and to Scott. Bye for now. I'm so in love with you. Whatever you want to do, I'll
is what I need. Let me be the one you come running to. I'll never be